Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Morality and Socially Constructed Norms by Laura Valentini. Narrated by Wendy Tremont King. Introduction. Socially constructed norms, the formal and informal norms that regulate our interpersonal, social, and political lives, are all around us. From the ladies' first custom to the practice of queuing, from the religious norm that prescribes chastity before marriage, all the way to the complex demands that legal systems place on us. By socially constructed norms, I mean norms whose existence depends on the actual actions and dispositions of individuals. I contrast socially constructed norms with valid or critical moral norms. The latter, I assume, exist independently of individuals' actual behavior and dispositions, and may be legitimately employed to evaluate them. For instance, the norm that slavery is impermissible is a valid moral norm even in a slave society, namely, a society that fails to recognize the validity of that moral norm. Note also that the category of socially constructed norms is broader than that of informal social norms, as understood in the philosophy of social science. Socially constructed norms, on my view, also include formal legal norms. For an influential account of social norms developed from a game theoretic perspective, see Bicchieri. These definitional matters will be addressed at greater length in Chapter 1. A constant presence in our lives, socially constructed norms elicit mixed reactions. On the one hand, we feel their moral pull. We hold one another accountable relative to those norms, and respond to their violation with moral emotions such as resentment, disappointment, blame, and guilt. Later on, I will introduce the more technical notion of reactive attitudes, in line with P.F. Strawson's influential work. On the other hand, we look at them with suspicion. Even ostensibly innocuous norms may reflect problematic imbalances of power and contribute to injustice. In light of this ambivalence, it would be helpful to have a criterion telling us when, if ever, we are morally bound by socially constructed norms, and when we should instead disregard them. This book seeks to develop such a criterion. Its contribution is twofold. In Part 1, it provides a framework explaining when and why the fact that socially constructed norms require or forbid some course of action places us under corresponding moral obligations. In Part 2, it applies this framework to questions in moral, legal, and political philosophy, namely, 1. What grounds moral rights? 2. What, if anything, grounds the obligation to obey the law? And 3. Why even seemingly harmless violations of a political collective sovereignty are wrongful? This introductory chapter offers a broad overview of the book and presents the motivations behind it, its limitations, and its methodology. To get started, in Section 1, I describe a personal anecdote that sparked my interest in the present topic, and which I expect listeners will be able to relate to. The philosophical significance of my inquiry and the book's core claims will be elucidated shortly thereafter. In Section 2, I explain what it is for socially constructed norms to have moral normativity. In Section 3, I outline two desiderata that any plausible account of the moral normativity of socially constructed norms should satisfy. In Section 4, I sketch the argument developed in Part 1 of the book and anticipate how it meets the relevant desiderata. In Section 5, I offer an overview of the arguments in Part 2 of the book concerning moral rights, political obligation, and sovereignty. In Section 6, I discuss the book's ambitions and limitations. Section 7 concludes with some reflections on methodology. 1. Why the moral force of socially constructed norms? At the age of 17, I was sent to the UK on a study holiday. I attended a language school in Bristol, together with my good friend Marta. We decided that one weekend we should make a trip to London. We chose to travel by bus. On the designated day, we reached the bus stop and stood there for a few minutes, waiting for our National Express to arrive. When the bus arrived, Marta and I immediately approached the front doors. A few seconds later, we realized that virtually everyone was looking at us disapprovingly. A couple of people even shouted a few words at us, which our then rather basic knowledge of the English language didn't allow us to understand. Still, it was clear to us that they were not words of encouragement. We looked around, trying to figure out what was going on, but we were at a loss for a few seconds until the word line or queue was mentioned, probably queue, since we were in England. There was our sin. We had skipped the queue. The fact is, of course, that we had not even realized there was one. In Italy, where Marta and I come from, people do not queue at the bus stop. They gather around it in inchoate fashion. This may appear like an uncivilized custom to some, but I assure you it works. If you are having trouble imagining such behavior, think about people waiting for the train or the tube in the UK. They are dispersed along the platform. They do not queue. At any rate, once I realized that we had breached a local norm, I felt rather embarrassed, almost guilty. I knew I had not violated some fundamental moral requirement. Let's face it, thou shalt not skip the queue is not among the Ten Commandments. But I did feel like I had done something mildly wrong, for which an apology was in order. I had, unintentionally to be sure, breached a harmless local norm, and that didn't seem right to me. Although this is my first vivid memory of finding myself in this type of situation, that is, of local norm breach, there have been countless others. I suspect that I am in good company here. For example, upon returning from trips to Germany, friends have recounted anecdotes involving faux pas with streetlights. The typical scenario features someone crossing an empty road on a red light. Yet, being the target of visible disapproval from the locals, who dutifully wait for the light to turn green. In all likelihood, I have also been guilty of this kind of misstep, only not in recent years. Being married to a German, and ironically having moved to Germany shortly before completing this book, I have become familiar with the local customs. But if I did safely cross on a red light in Germany, I know I would be at least mildly embarrassed. I would tell myself, you shouldn't have done that, and feel the need to apologize to those around me. But why? After all, crossing on a red light, when there is no traffic, is perfectly fine both in Italy, where I am from, and in London, where I lived most of my adult life. Unless there are small children around, in which case one shouldn't model potentially dangerous behavior. I never feel guilty or embarrassed when I do it in these other places. How could a mere change in location affect the moral quality of what is essentially the same behavior? Am I just reacting to social pressure, or is there something genuinely morally problematic in breaching local norms? The moral importance of local norms was brought home to me even more strongly in response to an episode that occurred at the start of my time as a faculty member at a previous university at which I worked. The then head of the university had authorized the launch of a particular initiative without having the official power to do so. Some crucial committee approvals were missing. His reason for acting in this way was a plausible one. One could predict that the committees would have approved the initiative, and a delayed launch might have cost the university the opportunity for some funding. Perhaps, all things considered, the university head did the right thing. In the circumstances, it may have been in the university's best interest to go ahead. Yet, I and several others felt that his conduct involved a pro tanto, though perhaps not in all things considered wrong, a form of action ultra vires that required acknowledgement as well as an apology. But why did we feel like this? Let's assume, for the sake of argument, that the university head had done the right thing. Moreover, the norms he breached were in some sense arbitrary. The rules governing the university's decision-making could have been different. Other universities are organized differently. It's not that the university head had breached some independent, fundamental moral principle. Yet, my sense that something had been done for which an apology was owed wasn't diminished by my awareness of the fact that the alleged wrong consisted in the breach of a socially constructed norm, a contingent human creation. The intellectual challenge was justifying this intuitive sense to myself. What plausible moral principle could explain this apparent wrong? Was it defensible to react to this norm breach with judgments and emotions akin to those appropriate in cases of moral violations? These are all examples of circumstances in which the question of the moral normativity of socially constructed norms arose for me in my personal life. The same question also came up in my academic life. This happened when I started working on the age-old problem of political authority and obligation. The problem really is age-old. For instance, it is famously discussed in Plato's Crito, which describes events taking place in 399 BCE. Do we have a moral obligation to obey the law because it is the law? And if we do, what grounds it? Could we be morally obligated to obey democratically approved laws, even if these are somewhat unjust? Of course, there is an ongoing debate on these questions. But what matters here is what the debate is about. When legal and political philosophers speak of the obligation to obey the law, or of the authority of law, they refer to the following alleged phenomenon. The fact that a law, that is, a particular type of socially constructed norm, requires us to act in certain ways, places us under a moral obligation to comply. I am assuming a positivist account of the nature of law, that is, one according to which the content of law is given by social facts, as opposed to evaluative considerations about its goodness or moral merits. I take such an account to be broadly in line with our common sense views about the nature of law. For general discussion of legal positivism, see Green. I shall return to this matter in Chapter 5. Even in legal and political philosophy, then, the question of the moral normativity of socially constructed norms has a central role to play. It is just that the debate is focused on one class of norms only, legal ones. By putting together the already existing literature on this topic and my own personal experiences, the idea for this book took shape. Legal and political philosophers have, for a long time, tried to explain the moral normativity of legal norms in particular. But the phenomenon of interest, which calls for an explanation, is much broader than that. We not only feel the moral pull of legal norms, but of all kinds of socially constructed norms, including informal ones. In fact, sometimes informal norms have even greater purchase on us than legal ones. I, for one, don't feel that crossing an empty street on a red light in Germany is any more wrong than skipping the queue in the UK. The legal status of the norm breached in the former case makes no difference to my personal sense of wrongdoing. And I can think of cases where breaching an entrenched custom would strike me as considerably worse, morally speaking, than breaching a little-known law. If these considerations seem plausible, then we should ask when and why, if ever, socially constructed norms, no matter their pedigree, have moral normativity. I take it that this question is of interest independently of whether one shares my intuitions about particular cases of norm breaches. You may find it peculiar that I'd feel guilty about crossing on a red light in Germany. In fact, I am certain many of you do. And you may think that my university head had nothing to apologize for. But unless you are never in the grip of any of the norms, legal or otherwise, that you encounter in your environment, this book should have something to say to you, too. Moreover, even though the present question has not been directly explored in the philosophical literature, at least not in such general terms, it is of considerable philosophical significance. Some major dichotomies in contemporary moral, legal, and political philosophy presuppose competing answers to it. In moral philosophy, for example, universalists are reluctant to ascribe inherent moral force to local norms, while relativists see them as valid sources of moral normativity. In legal philosophy, anarchists insist that legal norms have no moral status, while advocates of the obligation to obey the law see legal imperatives as morally binding. In political philosophy, liberals insist on the value of the individual over and above the norms governing her community, while communitarians attach great importance to the practices shaping particular social contexts. Each side of these well-known divides has something important to say. This is why the divides are so persistent. But each side also fails to do justice to the complexity of the relationship between morality and socially constructed norms, or so I will suggest. That relationship, I argue in this book, is not an all-or-nothing affair. It is not that socially constructed norms either always have moral import or never do. In our practical deliberations, that is, when we are deciding what to do, we have reason to sometimes defer to socially constructed norms and to sometimes distrust them. The challenge is to identify a criterion telling us when and why we should defer rather than distrust, and vice versa. This is the task I set myself in part one of the book. As I will show in part two, with this criterion in hand, we can make some progress in relation to long-standing and important debates in moral, legal, and political philosophy. 2. Our topic in focus. This book is concerned with identifying the grounds and limits of the moral normativity of socially constructed norms. It seeks to uncover when and why the fact that an action is mandated or forbidden by a socially constructed norm renders that action at least pro tanto morally obligatory or forbidden. This phenomenon calls for an explanation because socially constructed norms alone cannot bring moral obligations into existence, or at least so I shall assume. One cannot derive an ought from an is. For critical perspectives on the widely accepted dogma, see, for example, Anscombe and Searle. Only moral principles can generate moral obligations. The search for the grounds of the moral normativity of socially constructed norms is thus the search for a moral principle P, that explains when and why the fact that a certain action is required or prohibited by socially constructed norms makes a difference to its moral status. To be sure, there are several ways in which socially constructed norms, coupled with familiar moral principles, make a difference to what we ought to do. For instance, the norm that one should drive on the left, coupled with the principle that one should not cause needless harm, results in our obligation to drive on the left. Alternatively, the social norm prevalent in certain countries that one should tip waiters, coupled with the principle that one should not frustrate legitimate expectations, results in our obligation to leave a tip at the end of our meal. For general discussion of legitimate expectations, see Meyer and others. What is more, faced with the questions, why ought you to drive on the left and why ought you to tip waiters? It is natural to respond, because local norms require that I do. We might thus be led to believe that the no needless harm principle and the legitimate expectations principle are two candidate grounds for the moral normativity of socially constructed norms. In just one paragraph, we already seem to have made progress toward answering our question. Isn't that great? Unfortunately, things are more complicated than they seem. Neither the driving nor the tipping examples offer an illustration of the phenomenon I am after. In both cases, socially constructed norms contingently cause certain empirical facts. That is, people driving on the left, waiters forming certain expectations. And this, in turn, activates the demands of independent moral principles. The demands of said principles are not triggered by the fact that driving on the left and tipping are norm-mandated activities. If people just happened to drive on the left, without this being prescribed by a socially constructed norm, the obligation to drive on the left on harm avoidance grounds would kick in all the same. Similarly, if legitimate expectations were caused by something other than the operation of a norm, the obligation to satisfy them would continue to exist. In other words, these examples do not illustrate the moral significance of socially constructed norms, but show that the contingent causal effects of such norms may activate moral demands. When speaking of the moral normativity of socially constructed norms, I have something else in mind. Our being under obligations to perform certain actions because those actions are mandated by socially constructed norms, not because such norms have certain causal effects. To get a better sense of what this means, consider again our driving and tipping examples. Suppose we find ourselves on a completely empty street, with no witnesses, and no risk of any vehicle turning up in the next 5 minutes. In such a situation, whether we drive on the left or on the right makes no difference to anyone's safety. Still, a socially constructed norm mandates that we drive on the left. By virtue of what principle, if any, does this very fact, independently of its causal effects, morally obligate us to keep driving on the left? Or suppose Bob is a regular customer at a restaurant where you're a waiter. Bob is known for never tipping. Consequently, as Bob is paying his bill, you form no expectations that he will leave you a tip. The legitimate expectations principle is thereby disabled. Does Bob nonetheless do something wrong by violating the requirements of an existing norm? Southwood and Friedrich discuss the ethics of promising, but offer an example that has inspired my own here. These are the kinds of questions I wish to address. Answering them in the affirmative requires finding a moral principle, P, capable of explaining why the very fact that local norms mandate or prohibit certain actions matters morally. 3. Desiderata. We have seen that grounding the moral normativity of socially constructed norms requires identifying a suitable moral principle, P. But what exactly would make a candidate principle, P, a good one? Throughout the book, I assume that two basic familiar desiderata have to be explained: explanatory power and fit. Explanatory power. The explanation is powerful, which means that it makes the phenomenon in question less surprising. Explanatory power is a topic much debated in the philosophy of science. I am here drawing on the notion proposed by Schuppach and Sprenger. Explanatory power is a familiar desideratum for any theoretical or scientific enterprise. A candidate principle, P, will satisfy it by showing that the moral normativity of socially constructed norms does not magically spring out of empirical facts, but follows from familiar moral commitments. In doing so, P will take away the surprise element from our phenomenon of interest. To see how an explanation can be more or less powerful in this sense, consider this simple example. I find my window open upon returning home from a quick trip to the supermarket. This is surprising. I was expecting it to be closed. What could possibly explain this? Here are some candidate explanations. 1. I forgot to close the window before leaving the apartment. 2. Strong wind opened the window. 3. A burglar broke in. And 4. The Secret Services were spying on me and left abruptly when they heard I was coming back. Suppose today is a calm, sunny day with no wind. And suppose that the burglar alarm, which is very reliable, did not go off and indicate a break-in. Nor is there any evidence of theft. Finally, suppose, though there's not much need to suppose here, that I lead a very inconspicuous life. None of my activities are of any interest to the Secret Services. Given all this, explanations 2 and 3 are more or less ruled out. And although explanation 4 might remain logically consistent with the explanandum, it appears extremely far-fetched. It would be a conspiracy theory. The occurrence of 4 would be more surprising than the event we are trying to explain. Its explanatory power is therefore minimal. Explanation 1 is clearly superior. It points to a familiar phenomenon, namely, accidentally forgetting to close a window, which is straightforwardly connected to the explanandum, the window being open. By the same token, to meet the explanatory power desideratum, our principle P should be independently plausible and familiar, so as to make an apparently mysterious phenomenon, that is, the moral normativity of socially constructed norms, a simple consequence of our already held moral views. Let me now turn to our second desideratum. Fit. The explanation fits the available evidence. Once again, this desideratum is familiar with scientific endeavors. A good scientific explanation of an empirical phenomenon must fit the observed data. Since here we are focusing on moral rather than empirical facts, our target explanation should fit the appropriate data. Our judgments about the moral bindingness of socially constructed norms. I mentioned at the outset that these norms elicit mixed reactions. Sometimes we feel their moral pull, other times we find them pernicious. Principle P should vindicate the moral force of those socially constructed norms we intuitively think of as binding. While not conferring any such force on those we find problematic. This is not to say that a candidate principle P would have to be discarded right away.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?